If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Healthcare for Humans, hosted by Dr. Sundar, expands our understanding of the history and culture of different communities and how to provide culturally responsive care. There's an episode you should check out where guest Dr. Duran details the systemic barriers faced by individuals with DACA status and highlights the importance of addressing these barriers. Check out Healthcare for Humans on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. This is episode 144 of the podcast. If you're new to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is your place for trusted health guidance and support. Whether you're looking to improve your health or just seeking ways to stay well, we're here for you. This growing community is on a mission to improve our state of being and experience together on the planet. And if you love the conversations and insight you get here, consider becoming a health amplifier. You can support the show for as little as the price of a cup of coffee by going to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. Your support is more helpful than you can imagine. I got to have a great chat with Eva Minkoff, my guest for today's show. She has a TED Talk that's worth watching titled 5 Minutes to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. She's worked in a number of different sectors of health, from nutrition to researcher to health technology, and even as a podcast host. We connected through her involvement with the Health Podcast Network, which I joined this past year. Just another way in which I seek to broaden my connections and outreach with this project. I highly recommend becoming a member if you do have a health podcast yourself. Her TED Talk caught my attention because it's clear that she has a passion for improving care. Beyond that, she sees the most important part of making this change has to do with improving human connection, regardless of the state of the systems and insurance. This is a conversation everyone should be involved with because we all need to feel more empowered to have a role in improving our experience. So I welcome your comments, feedback, and suggestions after listening to this one. Here's my conversation with Eva Minkoff. So the thing that when I first was connected with you on Health Podcast Network, after I, you know, checked out your profile, the first thing I did was watch your TED Talk. And immediately I was like, oh, I'm going to have plenty to talk about with this person because it overlaps so many things that I've been interested in the 26 years I've been working, but also because I came from a health challenge, back problems and kind of chronic pain issues. So I just, you know, I think when you start at that point, you learn a lot about the health care system and about, you know, how involved you want to be in it and what you can sort of do on your own. And so I'm curious, you know, what your starting point was. I know you were a neuropsych major. Did you have a thought about going into healthcare as a field, or were you always kind of more interested in research?
So that's a bit of a multifaceted response because it's definitely a yes and. Yeah. I found myself what looked like scrambling within the world of healthcare for the last 15 years. I did a degree in neuropsychology. Then I followed that with a degree in nutrition science. Then pursued both of those together in my own practice, and then pivoted completely into health tech.
Okay.
And I did that for 4 years. And then I ended up building a community of tens of thousands of people with chronic illnesses, rare and invisible primarily. Then I got into media and marketing, and I've been in podcasting for a long time. And throughout all of those, there have been internships and other projects that address things like the cost of care and payers and continuity of care. To sum it all up, I have been involved in probably every facet of healthcare. Like, I dare people to throw at me something that I may have not worked in or had experience with in some ways. And that's professionally. Personally, I have been a chronic patient since I was 12 years old.
Oh, wow.
Well over 20 years now. And I mean, I guess in some ways I was a chronic patient my whole life, but I started seeing specialists at 12 for chronic shoulder joint pain. Mm-hmm. Long story short is I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, but I wasn't diagnosed with that until I was 30.
Okay.
It's a long time. So I've been through the system in a nutshell, in and out, in and out, in and out. Some terrible experiences, some uplifting experiences, and a lot in between. And so I have so much experience to draw from as a patient. But then I also had many different opportunities to see through the eyes of both the system and those who provide care. And I want to end on what I think has been maybe the catalyst for my biggest projects and my desire to make this a lifelong journey is the marriage to my husband, and he is a physician. So now I can see through the doctor's eyes in a completely different way, I guess as close as I could possibly be to being one myself in terms of the experience. And then anyone who's the wife or the partner of a physician has like a completely different way of looking at not just healthcare, but the world. So anytime I meet someone who's the spouse of a healthcare provider, I'm like, I get you.
Totally. Yeah. And you know, my background, because I've worked within so many different fields of care. I started out as a body worker, got into working more with the things that I was struggling with and trying to learn those things, you know, but then, and that led me into kind of movement arts and foundational and functional movement stuff. And then when I moved back to Minneapolis a little over 10 years ago, I met a doctor who wanted to work kind of with integrative health, and he was already in the midst of a health tech project, and a lot of what he was working on was care collaboration, communication challenges. And I had already kind of been working on this idea for ways to basically improve exactly what you've been kind of working on, getting those proper referral matches and making sure that you got to the right kind of person for yourself. And I explored this, you know, and spent a lot of money trying to see if that was something I wanted to do. And if I wanted to really kind of be, you know, somebody who was running a health tech project, because I had no background at all. I'm a little older than you. So it wasn't something that came naturally to me, but I went and kind of explored the whole thing. I met this guy who started the MLS online, which is this real estate listing service, happened to be a friend of a friend. And so he was very nice and kind of, I explained what I was thinking about and the ways in which, you know, you could probably more easily connect people to the right type of care and also make sure that that was a good match. And he thought it was a great idea, but he was like, you know, in real estate, we have all these ways of referral fees and making sure that people get to the right person, but that can't really work the same way in healthcare. But I think there are a lot of ideas still that I've been kicking around this whole time. And part of it is that I build a lot of networks around my practice so that I always have, you know, as close as I can, a good referral for somebody that comes in, where it's most of the time I'm the end of the chain. So they've been to, you know, dozens of people a lot of times before they see me. But but there are people who are also healthcare, you know, averse. And in that case, I want them to get, you know, the proper scans and anything that they need to do so that I really know what I'm working with. So you know, I've kind of been around that whole thing too. But I'm curious where your project is at this point.
So while I won't speak of anything in particular right now because it hasn't fully come to fruition.
Right.
I will say that everything that I work on focuses on how relationships are the foundation to put it plainly, fixing healthcare. I have yet to find any aspect of what's wrong with our healthcare system that cannot be at least partially solved or improved through human relationships. Right. And yes, doctor-patient relationships are a huge part of that, but they're not the only part of that. That could be relationships within leadership, staff members, it's care teams. Everyone involved is a human, right? And that's what we all have in common and acknowledging that shared humanity is much more than what I feel like the industry makes it sound like, which is like this fluffy stuff. Oh, it's feelings. But right. The truth is, and there's been a lot of proof around this now, that all decisions are emotional decisions, right. First of all.
Yeah.
So whether we'd like to admit that or not, they are inherently emotional decisions. And we all interact with people, and they influence how we look at the world, look at others, and ourselves.
Right.
So if we just ignore this foundational issue of a lack of relationship, we're never, in my opinion, going to be able to fully solve anything and improve healthcare the way I know that so many of us long for,
right,
and need it to.
And you, what I was, it was a very clever way of starting your TED talk to talk about it from an online dating perspective, because we are interviewing the people that are going to be our care providers, and it doesn't take us very long. I mean, they don't have very long with us. So, you know, we go into it hopefully with a good referral. Sometimes it's from a family or you know, a friend, but oftentimes it's from another care provider that we've worked with. And, you know, it's pretty clear right away whether, as you put it, you know, they're either listening and interested in our story, or they know the limitation of what they can do with you, and they're already past, you know, listening to you. They're already kind of thinking about what's next without even going through your whole story. And that's, you know, that's a big part of what I picked up from your TED talk was, and the way that I think about working with people in general is, I need to know the whole story. You know, I start with a very simple intake, partly because I don't want, you know, I know that this conversation is going to evolve and I'm going to get more and more information, but I have sort of some basic points. And a lot of that is, I want to know the background. I want to know if there are some very big, you know, moments that may have impacted this, timelines and that kind of stuff. And I can usually get that within a few questions. So I don't have to go through so much, because I'm going to do my own diagnostics and then start asking questions. And in that first session, I'm asking tons of questions that are off of that intake form. I mean, away from the intake form, not from the intake form.
So in my talk, first of all, it is now 4 years old.
Yeah.
While I still think everything I said holds true, what I really want people to take away from it, you know, this isn't really a spoiler, but yeah. I do hope people listen, because everyone gleans something different from it, is that the whole patient, the whole person matters. So right. In it, I talk about certain questions you can ask in your approach to essentially intake. But even if that wasn't what we were looking at, like the kinds of questions to ask, but even just what's a way in very short period of time, not just 5 minutes, but maybe 5 seconds, that we can create connection, that we can mm-hmm. create trust in this relationship.
Yeah.
We all know you can break trust in 5 seconds. You can break trust by looking at someone the wrong way.
Yeah.
So I've thought a lot about and tested out with some doctors and patients what it is we can do within these moments, let's just call them moments, yeah. that will make or break a relationship. And how does that then create a ripple effect for the right questions, yeah. and for not just right questions, but from the patient's perspective, revealing that which can change the trajectory of a diagnosis or treatment plan.
Yeah.
And those are statements that encapsulate what all humans need, like their basic emotional needs. And in my opinion, you can summarize those in 5 points, and that's connection, safety and security, autonomy, meaning and purpose, and belongingness. This is mm-hmm. what all of us have in common and what we all need as humans to emotionally function properly.
Yeah.
And as I said in the talk, respect, communication, and trust within the relationship.
Yeah.
So all of these things can be conveyed in a very short period of time. And some examples of that, I'm actually going to start with my favorite one that I wish a doctor or many doctors use with me in my journey to fibromyalgia. And that is, I believe you. It's incredible how powerful a statement like that can be. Even if that was the only effort you made to connect with the human in front of you, and everything else was more clinical and, you know, what a lot of people rush to fit in into appointment, that changes the game.
Yeah.
Because it is a demonstration that I see you as human and I trust you and what you say and your experience, and I'm here for you. You can say so much in so few words. They say a picture says 1,000 words. I think 3 or 4 words can say 1,000 words.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. And that moment of saying I believe you also says, you know, that I want to know more, you know, right there, without going any further. Because, you know, I think we forget that the patient knows so much more about their own experience. And also, I mean, I'm always checking with that early on to find out what has been working, what's not working, what was the original diagnosis, what do you believe to be true about that original diagnosis? Because I'm sure you've had numerous diagnoses over that period from 12 to 30.
Yeah, it's so actually something to, again, take away from this questionnaire that I talk about in the study is that there's a whole person in front of you. Mm-hmm. It's not just their diagnosis, their symptoms. They're not a number. They're not data on a chart. They are a person that has a whole life. So in this questionnaire, I touch on how you ideally would love to know how a person views each part of their life. But what really the takeaway is there is you have to see that person that way, even if you can't get all that information. I would love people to spend more time and gather more information from patients. But if you just acknowledge them as human and see them that way, as you said, it's like, it's really remarkable what comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I feel like a lot of doctors really don't recognize and the system doesn't recognize is that not having a diagnosis is definitely not the worst thing. Doctors admitting when they don't know the problem does not mean that they have failed and does not mean that the patient has to look at it as failure or disappointment.
Mm, yeah.
I've had many doctors, some like of my good interactions, end with a doctor letting me know that they didn't have a diagnosis for me. But what I remember isn't the fact that they let me down with a lack of diagnosis. I remember the compassion they gave me and the support they gave me in how not only how they delivered it, but how I would move forward from there. They either referred me to someone else or gave me some ideas for managing my pain or gave me some other places to look. Like I felt supported, heard, cared for, and even capable. Like there was something else I could do and that they were there for me. I definitely don't look back on those interactions with doctors and think, ugh, they were awful because they didn't diagnose me properly or didn't diagnose me at all.
Yeah, I'm always a little suspicious if someone thinks they know exactly what it is. Because I know from my work, you know, because I'm a craniosacral therapist, you know, now more than anything else, I tend to get people sent to me who are really struggling with some kind of autonomic, you know, regulatory, you know, function. So that can affect your histamine levels. It can affect inflammation. I primarily work with the dural membrane system and the fascial system. So I know that, you know, because it's an innervated system, that when we go through stressful time periods, that system is also going to probably be affected the most, you know. So, and you know, I'm sure the husband probably agrees with this, but you can put a Venn diagram of things that I think, you know, sort of overlap. There are things that, the reason that we can't always come up with a complete diagnosis is there might be 5 different things, and we need to kind of prioritize that and say, let's focus on this because this seems to be primarily symptomatic. But then as we sort of peel away that layer, we might find other things. So to say that it's only one thing, I think is also a little tricky for some people because they think that when they get the medication or when they do the treatment or whatever for it, and sometimes, as you mentioned in the TED Talk, sometimes those treatments are very painful. painful, and they can be a little bit traumatic, you know. So you know, it's a real process to get somebody, and I've been through it myself, to get, you know, to a place where they feel comfortable in the new place that they are, because sometimes we get very used to the way that we were, you know, sort of that neurologically programmed place of pain. We start looking for it everywhere. You know, that was kind of my you know, feeling coming out of back pain was, it's a, you know, PTSD maybe with a small p, but I still felt like I was always looking for the thing that might set it off again. And, you know, 28 years later, I am pretty out of it. I'm kind of surprised at myself sometimes. And I think some of my patients and clients that I treat are sort of surprised that I actually did come from that place, because I may not look that way anymore. But I think it's part of what gives me the confidence that somebody else can get out of it.
And I think you actually touched on something really significant there, just because, let's say there is like one diagnosis or one type of treatment that really is best. It's not, it affects who you are and your life, especially if we're talking about a chronic illness. So yeah. That's something else that I think is important for doctors to realize, is you might be giving them this treatment that looks very black and white to you, but what does it look like in their life, both short term and long term?
Yeah.
How are you as a patient going to see your life long term? Is this an optimistic view, a pessimistic view? How is it going to affect what you see as possible? Actually, a good example of how your belief system will affect you long term around maybe a one diagnosis or one approach to treatment is it becomes part of your identity, especially right. If you have a chronic illness. You know, that's something I've been asked a few times. What's the difference between a chronic and acute patient? And with a chronic patient, it is now what defines your life.
Right.
And I'm not saying that in a pessimistic way. I'm a very positive person, actually. It doesn't mean that I let it run me in a passive sense, like, oh, I have this and therefore I have to live my life a certain way. But it's just going to inevitably determine certain things that I do, think, feel, say. And that is just going to be one of the many things on my list that define how I live and look at my life.
Yeah.
Now, if you have an acute issue, that doesn't mean that it can't do the same, because a lot of acute issues have long-term repercussions, like a car crash and affecting your mental health,
yeah.
Let's say. Chronic conditions show up in a lot of different ways that I don't think we acknowledge also. All that to say that a doctor who's treating you, while they may not, I'm not saying they need to empathize fully to the point where this is going to affect them and they take it home. But in the moment, them understanding that you are a person that has a full life, and whatever you decide, hopefully together in partnership, is going to affect that life,
yeah,
is necessary.
Yeah. And you know, when it comes to maybe the difference between a chronic and acute condition, because this is actually on my intake form, and a lot of people don't know what acute means. So, you know, so because part of what I'm trying to understand is, How long has this been with you? How long have you been experiencing symptoms from this? And is there anything that you've been experiencing for a long time? So, you know, somebody who comes into me with, say, you know, tailbone pain may also have a history of chronic headaches, but the tailbone pain may be a newer thing, or maybe they think it's a newer thing. And then sometimes we find out, oh, actually you've had multiple tailbone injuries. So, which could be affecting things. But for, you know, for myself, just as an example, I found out probably about the 15 years in that, as I was getting, I was definitely, you know, better at that point. I had learned a lot about sort of how to, you know, manage some of the pain and take care of things a little bit better, but I was still having flare-ups from time to time. But I had a PT who figured out that because she worked with dancers, that I have a ligament laxity issue, that, you know, all my, you know, joints are kind of gummy, you know, my hands will just kind of collapse down into nothing, you know, like that's, and that kind of, what that does is that's something that I'm always going to have for the most part. It may stiffen up as I get older, but I mean, I'm in my 50s and I still have the same kind of condition. So that meant I had to really think more about how do I support my spine and the ligament, you know, laxity challenge that I have, and you know, with different kinds of exercises, and that's made a huge difference. But the chronic part is this ligament laxity issue that I'm always going to have to kind of manage on some level. And I think a lot of people have things like that, and that, you know, that could be vascular, it could be lymphatic, it could be, you know, any number of things, and you know, yours is the fascial system, you know, for the most part, and probably some kind of inflammatory response that goes along with it.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a complicated
system
going on. I have a hard time defining what's what, and I don't know how important that is anyway, in terms of like symptoms belonging to what diagnosis.
Right, but sort of knowing what kind of what, I mean, I always think about things as things kind of exist within a spectrum. Like, you know, this is why I'm always a little bit like, one diagnosis is probably not the whole story. That we kind of need to know what those different pieces are that we're kind of working on.
So I want to share actually how I got diagnosed with fibromyalgia, because I thought this was really fascinating.
Yeah, I'm interested.
So I was diagnosed by a neurologist. This was like 13, 14 years ago now. And before he gave me the formal diagnosis of fibromyalgia, which still I feel like was taboo, maybe it even is still now. I don't know. I'm so in the world.
There are some people who sort of question it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. At least there are like diagnostic codes now for it. So that legitimizes it.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, so this doctor, once he had done a physical exam and asked me a number of questions, he then asked me, did you have a traumatic childhood? And I was really taken aback by that. And I was like, I'm very curious about what's wrong with me, so I will answer your question. And I'm very thankful to report that I did not. I have phenomenal parents. I was very loved. I've had lots of opportunities. I'm very privileged. It's like, no, I had a great childhood. But he kept probing. He was like, you know, are you sure? Was there anything that, like, was there any particular trauma, or did you experience any chronic stress? I went, oh, well, that's a different question.
Yeah, I think it is, actually.
Yeah. I was a very serious, like professionally trained ballet dancer for 15 years.
Yeah.
I was like, aha, there we go. So was I abused by my parents? No, but you might say that I was like emotionally abused by my ballet directors and the girls that surrounded me every day. And just my body, the chronic physical stress on my body and the it's endless. And it hurts me to say that because I have like a love-hate relationship with ballet. You can call it like an abusive ex-partner.
Yeah,
like,
I understand it very well, because the same PT who helped me with my diagnosis started referring dancers to me because of, you know, what she, you know, saw were a lot of stress-related conditions and a lot of emotional challenges. And, you know, it's funny, she used to actually refer to herself, she used to travel with Merce Cunningham. And that troupe, and she would put her table up on the stage during rehearsals and practice before the shows, and she called herself the goat, which not the greatest of all time, but in horse racing, they put a goat in the stalls to try to get the horses to calm down ahead of time. Something about goats, I guess, but that's what she would do. She would just wander around the stage and just wait for someone to like want to be on her table or just smile at them or whatever. And you know, that was what I gathered from working with the dancers. It's, you know, there is a certain amount of chronic stress that goes on with, you know, both the physical, it's one of the most demanding, you know, athletic things that a person can do with their body. And then there's a lot of emotional stuff, and the dancing itself is emotional, and the people that you're surrounded with are emotional. So I totally get it.
Yeah, if anyone has ever seen Black Swan,
that's what I was thinking about too.
Yeah, that's what I tell them. I was like, without the psychosis, that was my life.
Yeah.
There's a scene where she gets the part of the Swan Queen, and she's crying in the bathroom. I cry every time because I get it. Like, I totally get why that is such a profound moment for her. But taking it back to the doctor, the reason I find it fascinating is that it was the first time I saw a doctor bridge the gap between clinical and seeing someone as greater than that. Because clearly, I think he'd even told me that hey, it turns out that we're finding most people with fibromyalgia, if not all, have experienced trauma or chronic stress in some way. This is the common denominator. So he was digging for a clinical purpose, right?
Yeah.
But he also wanted to see what it looked like for me. He didn't just do the checkbox, oh, well, she said she had no personal trauma. She had no family trauma, or some of the stuff that you immediately go to when you think about that. But like, what in your life looks like stress for you? So I know a lot of people that if they heard I was talking about ballet, they dismiss that and go, that's not trauma. That's not abuse. That's not stress. But he could see and also really heard when I was telling him this, that it was my everything. It was my identity at the time.
Yeah.
Still is, honestly. And, you know, I wish I knew who that doctor was. I never saw him again for some reason. But it was not for a lack of appreciation. He clearly had a big impact on my life.
Yeah.
And since then, I have become more aware of when doctors are looking into the context of my life. And that's something I really wanted to talk about here, is that my diagnosis, my symptoms are all within the context of my life as a person.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I went to a specialist when I was 12, kind of to reverse the experience, perfectly lovely doctor, top doc in New York City, you know, so on paper, as good as it gets. And when I told him I was a dancer, and I very clearly explained that I do it 6 days a week and it's my everything,
mm-hmm.
he was like, well, why don't you just stop dancing? And I responded, well, why don't you stop being a doctor?
Yeah. Well, I hear this all the time with like runners and stuff too, where they, you know, they have an injury or they start having some knee problems. And, you know, my feeling is if a person loves this thing, let's try to keep that, you know, that energy, because that's their life. And so, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, right. Like, we're talking about identity here.
Yeah.
It was a huge part of my identity. And let's say, clinically speaking, that was the right decision. I should have stopped ballet, which, by the way, apparently with EDS, it can be a protective factor. It's confusing to me.
Yeah.
It can be both, is the long story short. But let's say it would have been the best thing for me to stop ballet. The delivery of that recommendation matters. It could have been that he wanted to work with me on how to make dance a part of my life in a way that wouldn't hurt, at that time, my right shoulder, which was the worst. Or it could have been that his recommendation really was to stop. But how could I do that in a way that made sense for me? Or at the very, very, very least, showing me compassion for such a difficult realization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I understand that this is very hard for you, that this is very important for you. And I also know that you're in a lot of pain. You know, validation.
Yeah.
That would have been a game changer for how I perceived healthcare going forward, and maybe even how I would have handled what I was doing with my body. I was thinking about this the other day. There's a good chance that 12-year-old Eva pushed herself even harder because I was in denial or wanted to prove that doctor wrong. I don't know if that showed up differently clinically all these years later, but I wouldn't be surprised if I wanted to rebel because of the way that he told me what he did.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets back to what you're talking about in the TED Talk, which is it seems like your focus has been this patient provider connection, that there has to be that has to be a two way. And I feel like that is the challenge that we're having. And, you know, you talked about it in the TED Talk too, that, and, you know, with your husband being a doctor, that they're struggling on some level too with what they're allowed to do as providers. So, you know, I'm curious to, you know, since this was 4 years ago, I'm curious to know if there's anything that's changed in the way that you see that. I feel like you had a pretty clear vision of this. And I learned a lot about this from my, you know, brief period in, you know, 2.5 years in health tech, working with different doctors and trying to get a sense of like what were their challenges, and also surprised at how interested they were in my work, because I was at a point where I was like, I wasn't building that kind of bridge between, you know, what we call integrative care, which is not really happening at all for the most part. They're just pulling more and more of those services out of care, but or out of insurance, you know, coding. But that is the one thing that I really want to see that this bridge happening with. So I'm curious to know where you're at or what you've learned since that talk.
So to bring it back to the larger picture is that these are two humans in the interaction, right? The doctor is just as human as the patient is, and them being acknowledged as such makes all the difference. So small things like thanking a doctor for their time or their dedication, whatever it is, can be extremely impactful. For some professions more than others, just a funny anecdote my husband and I were talking about, when he was in Rochester, New York for his fellowship, he almost never received thank yous. And now we're in Central California and he receives thank yous all the time, to the point where when I asked him, hey, does a thank you at the end or at some point during the appointment make an emotional difference for you? And he said, I don't know. I don't think so. I get them pretty often. Ever since I mentioned that to him, he's been tuned into it. And he goes, actually, it does. Every time I hear it, it makes a difference. Yeah. So that's just a small example. They're being acknowledged for their work, their effort, their dedication. And it's also a demonstration of trust. It's like, thank you. You did what I wanted, expected, or at least validated me as a human. It's an exchange. And I actually would like to circle back to something I said earlier regarding the moments, like how do you make moments efficient to the point where it could take less than 5 minutes or 5 seconds to make all the difference.
Yeah.
So I mentioned, I believe you, like a provider saying to a patient. A few others could be, your well-being is my priority. You're not alone. We're in this together. Like, this is a partnership. Your input is valuable. I'm here to listen to you. Mm-hmm. Maybe even saying something like, you're capable of overcoming whatever these challenges are. And actually, this is a fun fact. I'm sorry I don't have the actual facts in front of me, but I do know that there's research on this. If you say to someone, take your time, or please don't feel like you need to rush, the person is usually more effective with their communication and actually more concise because the stress and the pressure is gone.
Yeah, I do that a lot, actually.
That's a fun fact. And now to turn the tables, just like saying thank you to a provider, patients can say very pithy things that make all the difference. Like, I appreciate your honesty and transparency if they've had to relay something difficult. Or knowing you're on my team makes me feel confident or gives me confidence. Thank you for explaining things to me clearly and patiently. I'm happy to say what I've created this list. It's a long list, and I feel like I've said pretty much all of them, which made me feel really good because I know that that's a person and I acknowledge them as a person. And believe me, I still get pissed off.
Yeah.
but I really want to make sure I acknowledge the moments where they acknowledge me.
Yeah, and it gives them the opportunity to connect to you too, because this was one of the things that I was hearing from a lot of doctors was, you know, so in my private practice, you know, as I was saying, people usually get to me after, you know, a lot of challenges. And so I get tons of positive feedback. And I also get people who are very engaged. Like, they're, if I, you know, and I'm pretty good about making sure that I don't give them too many things. If I know that there's going to be a process out of this, I might give them one thing to work on at a time. But the thing that I was hearing from so many people in allopathic care was that, you know, If 60% or something of the population that's coming in doesn't really care about their health that much, they just want something to make this go away now, and they're not going to engage, that's also very hard for healthcare workers to just, you know, deal with time after time. But by you saying something, by you acknowledging their engagement with you as a patient, that completely changes the relationship. And I think it also bonds us.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like you can say something both positively or negatively in a romantic relationship that could like make or break trust.
Yeah, for sure.
It can happen in an occupation relationship.
Yes. are there any, you know, takeaways at this point, besides what we've covered here? And if you're maybe seeking that kind of relationship, what are the things that you are looking for?
Curiosity is actually a major trait I would like to see in doctors more often. Mm. And like I said, if you give us the space and don't interrupt us, we actually may be way more succinct than you feel like we would be. I'm sure there's going to be exceptions, but if I feel like you actually care to know, not only am I going to reveal what's necessary, but most likely what I never would have even thought to reveal if not asked or prompted. And then to follow that is validation. Validation in whatever I'm saying, and maybe more importantly, what I'm feeling. Actually, definitely more importantly, what I'm feeling.
I think that's it.
Feelings are always valid. I don't care if they seem irrational. Your feelings are valid, period.
Yeah. And in that moment, and the next time you meet them, you may be in a totally different place. But just to know that you were acknowledged at that time period is huge, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. Thanks for sorting through all this with me. I feel like we could go through this topic for a long time. And I'm curious to watch what develops out of your work. And I feel like this is kind of the most important part of what needs to change. And I think it puts pressure on the way that, you know, insurance-based care is working too, because, you know, by acknowledging that this relationship needs to be strengthened, we're willing to kind of take new steps together, you know, I think in terms of how we address things.
And if I may say so, if there's really a takeaway, I would think a takeaway that applies to anyone listening. We all can play a role in our healthcare system. As I said, because we make up that system, and what that looks like is reminding yourself over and over and over again that other person in front of you, whether that be a doctor or a staff member or a patient, is human. And connecting on that level, just like a mental note that, hey, that person has loved and lost. That person has a job. That person may have a partner. They may have kids. They might be tired, you know, they might be going through a transition. Like, that is a person in front of you. And I think we need these constant reminders in order to not just change what healthcare looks like, but actually transform the system. And these could be people in leadership roles, and it could be in health tech, it could be in, I'd like to see what happens in the payer system. But all of us involved, if this is how we start looking at the people in front of us, it will alter and later transform the decisions that we make, and therefore what unfolds and what we build from here. Yeah. So in short, look at people like they're human.
Agreed.
Because guess what we are.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Eva. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Eva Minkoff, folks. It's so easy in any situation to forget that the stranger you're interacting with is someone else's son or mother or sibling with a life full of experiences we know nothing about. What matters is that we find some way to connect. Not every day will be our best day. We might be going through it, struggling, just getting through the day. But what's important is understanding that the person in front of us is going through their own thing. We need to respect each other at least this much. The goal is to seek connection, and it goes both ways. I recognize that the patient-provider relationship has a history of being one-sided, but I do see it changing. And the more we see each other's humanness, the more likely we'll have successful outcomes together. Let me know what you thought of this topic in conversation. You can reach out to me anytime by email at jeremy@highway2.health. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Healthcare for Humans, hosted by Dr. Sundar, expands our understanding of the history and culture of different communities and how to provide culturally responsive care. There's an episode you should check out where guest Dr. Duran details the systemic barriers faced by individuals with DACA status and highlights the importance of addressing these barriers. Check out Healthcare for Humans on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.